The Business of Biotech is produced by Life Science Connect and its community of learning, solving, and sourcing resources for biopharma decision makers. If you're working on biologics process development and manufacturing challenges, you need to swing by bioprocessonline.com. If you're trying to stay ahead of the cell or gene therapy curve, visit cellandgene.com. When it's time to map out your clinical course, let clinicalleader.com help. And if optimizing outsourcing decisions is what you're after, check out outsourcepharma.com. We're Life Science Connect, and we're here to help. So ADCs have been a bright spot on an otherwise gloomy biotech horizon, and Joe Farah knows it. Farah is CEO at Elevation Oncology, a biotech that's been making some strategic portfolio moves to maneuver its Claudin-18.2 targeting ADC EO-3021 into phase one study status. Longtime listeners of the Business of Biotech might be thinking, wait, Joe Farah, I thought Matt had Elevation CEO Sean Leland on the show a couple of years back. And you're not wrong. We'll get into that in just a minute. In the meantime, I am Matt Piller. This is the Business of Biotech. And on today's show, I'm excited to talk through some of the big moves Elevation has been making with its relatively new CEO and former CFO, Joe Farah. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Matt. I appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you and talk more about Elevation Oncology. And that's a great intro, so I appreciate it.
Oh, well, it was brief and to the point, but I appreciate your compliments there. Anytime I have the opportunity to spend some time with a company that's experienced some significant change over the course of the 18 or 24 months since I last talked to it, I welcome that company back on the show. And the change has not been insignificant at Elevation, both in terms of its leadership and its portfolio strategy. And that's the stuff I want to get into. But before we do, because you're new to me and perhaps new to our audience, I want to spend some time getting to know you. And you have everyone that I interview has an interesting background. There's elements of it that are interesting. Yeah. To me, when I look at yours, I see a guy who was like a science guy in academia, right? Like you studied chemistry, I believe, in undergrad. Yeah.
Yep. Chemistry in undergrad.
And you did some research for the NIH. Did some life science product work. And then at some point in those early phases, you kind of strode over to the finance side. And that's when things started to, at least on paper, it seems like that's when things really started kind of clicking for your career trajectory. So tell me a little bit about that initial intention. We'll dial it way back to your initial intention when you were, a science / NIH guy. And then that transition into the finance side of the business.
Yeah, sure. Well, I love talking more about that. I mean, like so many others, I wish I could say it was all part of a master plan, but along the way, I just had the benefit of a lot of mentors and a lot of people that sort of took me under their wing and helped me appreciate what other opportunities were out there. Like you said, going way back, in high school and going into college, I was a science nerd. I was a math and science nerd. And like many people at that age, you're not really sure what to do with it. There seems to be more opportunities available to you, and you're just not sure which direction is best. One of the best things I did, for a lot of reasons, when I was an undergrad in chemistry, at Purdue University, was I started working in the lab early in my undergrad years. As soon as I could, I started doing research, basic science research. And it was great because I learned a lot. Met a lot of great, smart people that did some really interesting things. But I also learned early on that the lab life wasn't for me. And, I enjoyed science. And like many of others, I was just looking for the right place. And I knew that the lab work was probably more limiting, while important and the cornerstone of everything we're doing in biotech. It just wasn't for me. So I sought out with finding ways of doing things a little bit differently. My experience was in analytical chemistry. You're right, I did do some work at the NIH, which also was some direct lab work. But it wasn't until I started working for a company called Thermo Electron, now it's Thermo Fisher, where someone there said, hey, you know, you've worked in the lab a lot, you have a lot of technical expertise. And, you know, there's a whole field of not just doing the science itself, but translating that science into what could be done with it and funding it and helping it grow in a way that getting the roadblocks out of the way, things that scientists aren't necessarily as good at as some of the more business people are. And that translated me being a sales rep for Thermo in the territory and selling what I like to call really expensive vacuum cleaners. And, you know, there's a lot of people in our industry who say, early on in their experience, like everything you learned about my career, everything I learned about business, I learned being a pharma sales rep or selling this or selling that. That's exactly how I felt about my experience at Thermo as a sales rep. To this day, a lot of the lessons I learned as a sales rep for Thermo still apply to my job in finance, as well as my career in leading a company like Elevation Oncology. You just learn to appreciate all the simple things that can make a big difference, you know, connecting with people first. You know, it's more about how you say things and less about what you're saying specifically. And it was a great education. The other thing I learned was, you know, having worked in the lab and then selling to those people that were also doing lab, I could walk the walk and talk the talk. So I knew what they had experienced. So I was able to leverage that direct experience in order to help find better solutions for them. So it was through all that that I realized that, you know, while historically my focus was in science, it was really the business of science was probably where my set of skills was more relevant. I knew eventually that I wanted to get into finance. Again, as a chemistry nerd in undergrad, I didn't take one business course. I didn't take one finance course. I was straight down the fairway on science. And I knew I needed to go back and round out that skill set. I got my MBA. And if you had asked me at the time, again, I would have probably geared towards working in a finance organization at a large pharmaceutical company. But I met individuals who were investment banking, and they again told me that my skill set could be more aptly progressed towards helping companies like Elevation and other companies in biotech work through the more strategic problems. A big part of that is funding, right? Because a lot of what's doing in biotech cannot happen unless you have the capital to move it forward. And investment banking I did for almost 15 years was an incredible experience in not only just meeting a lot of great people, but also learning a lot of the strategic opportunities and challenges that companies in our sector have to deal with. And then, you know, eventually it just became clear it was the right next step to sort of turn that to put my money where my mouth is and see what it takes to actually run a company directly. And I first had the opportunity to do that as CFO, and now lucky enough and fortunate enough to do it as a chief executive officer.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about that transition in a minute. I just want to reflect on, you know, as you can imagine, I talk to biotech leaders who have come from virtually every background you can imagine. I once had a biotech CEO on the show who in a previous life was like the director of marketing for Kraft macaroni and cheese. That's no way. Like just every facet. But to your point, marketing, finance, sales. I've had a couple of execs who started out their careers, you know, carrying the bag, as we like to say, doing pharma sales.
Exactly right.
And that I think that like that kind of experience gives you an appreciation unparalleled, right? If you come in from the VC side, or if you come in solely from the finance side, if you're just a business guy and you started it out with that pedigree, like you don't have that level of, I guess, relatability, right? To the folks on the streets. It's incredible. But you seem to have checked a lot of the boxes that kind of culminate with an opportunity, you know, the skill set to take advantage of the opportunity you have right now. So
And one of the, you know, it's tongue in cheek, but, you know, in my many years as an investment banker, technically I was in the finance business, and I'm one of those people where to this day, like doing math in my head doesn't really fly. Like I'm the guy that as soon as it goes beyond moving a decimal place, I got to get out the calculator and do it. And you know, people will be like, how can you know, you work in finance. Like, how do you not like that with numbers? Well, the reality is that my entire career in finance, I've always said that I'm not in the numbers business. I'm in the people's business. And that applies to so many things because, and that goes back to being a sales rep. I mean, whether you're selling vacuum cleaners, you're selling encyclopedias, or you're selling, you know, multi-million dollar mass spec equipment for to scientists, some of those baseline things hold true. It's about connecting with people, understanding what they're truly looking for, and seeing if you have a solution for them that's really going to help. And some of those early things and basic things, you know, while we often in life try to overcomplicate things, those are some of the things that I think don't change and should stay simple.
Yeah. Yeah. When you joined Elevation, it was just a little more than a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep. A little over 2 years ago. Yes.
Yep. Joined as CFO, and obviously had accumulated some good finance experience by then. But what was it that attracted you to the opportunity to run Point on finance for an emerging biopharma company?
Yeah, you know, it's all about the challenges. There's
you've had those in spades, my friend.
Yes, yes. In the business of science, right? I always say there's a zone in the middle, which is. To some degree, we all can't completely predict what the science is going to do. So on the one, think of it a barbell. On one end, if the science doesn't work, you can be the smartest group of people in the world. It's probably not going to make a difference. On the other end of the spectrum, if the science is so great and so perfect, even the hardest try at messing it up isn't going to mess it up. But in the middle, right, there's a large zone in the middle, that gray area in the middle, where there's millions or hundreds of incremental decisions that the team has to make over time that can make the difference between success and failure. And when I say success and failure, I mean success in terms of getting to a drug that helps patients. And I think it's in that zone, it's in that gray area where there are so many little, but add them all up, they're big decisions that need to happen in order to get from point A to point B to point C. And hopefully for the greater good overall. I've always been attracted. I think most people, you know, at this stage, you know, you get jazzed and you get excited about the opportunities and the challenges, and you hope to maximize some and minimize the other. And it's that overall walk and journey that I continue to think is incredibly rewarding, and why I thought, for my skill set and my experience, that I wanted my journey to be part of a development stage biotech.
Yeah. How did you get in there? Just curious, like what the backstory is. Was it an opportunity that just crossed your desk? Did you know Sean? Like what was sort of that story?
Yeah. So Sean and I had previous history, but the real impetus, as well as other individuals at Elevation Oncology, was what we were aiming to do as a company. You know, it was, Elevation doesn't have, when it was founded, didn't have a traditional science-based platform as is usually defined for a biotech company. From the very beginning, the idea was to not be beholden to one specific type of technology or one specific type of modality, to be able to use business development and partnerships to expand the pipeline, and as well as to develop drugs that can make a difference. And it was that sort of open playing field that the concept that Elevation had, that based on my background, I thought was an incredible opportunity to do something unique. And while there are plenty of other things related to it, that probably is the crust of why in the beginning, I was really compelled with what Elevation was building and why I wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah. So you join a CFO, you're in the CFO role for a little while, and then some circumstances arise that lead to Sean's departure and your move into, I think originally the interim CEO seat and then onto the executive position. So what were those circumstances?
Yeah. So we, like many other companies over the past couple of years, have always had to think long and hard about making sure we're putting our resources, both capital and human resources, towards the best opportunities available to us. And that rubber hit the road on that for us as a company last year when we had our prior lead program, seribantumab, which was a program upon which the company was founded. Mm-hmm. And then we had our current lead program, as you mentioned in the beginning, EO3021, which is an anti-claudin 18.2 antibody drug conjugate. We in-licensed rights from a Chinese company for that program, and it became very clear that because of our belief and our conviction that EL3021 was going to be an incredibly meaningful opportunity for patients in a very high unmet area of need, that the best thing we could do for our company, for the patients, and for our stakeholders overall was invest in 3021 as much as possible. The unfortunate part was that meant that seribantumab, which was clearly also a drug that was making a difference for patients, and we presented data like that last year at a medical conference, mm-hmm. that meant that it just wasn't the right choice for us to drive that forward. So we essentially paused that program, seeking to find the right partner, because we do think there's the right home for that somewhere. It's just a matter of finding that right home. And then with the transition of the pipeline, you know, it became clear that Sean, who built this company from the ground up, and to this day, a lot of our key tenets for how we think about things was based on his leadership and what he instilled in us as a company. But with moving forward with 3021 as our lead program and thinking about the next evolution of the company, the board and the team thought it gave me the trust in thinking that and seeing that I was the right person to help lead them to the next stage of evolution. And I'm incredibly thankful and proud to be able to have that opportunity. And it's been a really intense year in 2023 since we made those changes as a company. Yeah. And we're only getting started. So there's a lot more to go.
Did you have what was part of that trust and I guess faith that was instilled in you with the new program based on some prior experience in the ADC space? I mean, was that sort of a forte of yours, or?
So for me specifically, I will be the first to admit that ADCs are not part of my prior experience. Mm. But the strength of the chief medical officer and the chief scientific officer, Valerie Jensen and David Dornan in particular, was a key part of our competitive advantage in ADCs. For me, I think it was just the right combination of what Elevation needed in its next stage in the leader and the chief executive officer. And with my background in finance and my background in making sure companies have the capital they need in order to move forward, every leader at any point in time, any situation, you know, you have to say, do I have the right skills to bring it to the next level? And I think in this case, and thinking through the challenges that Elevation was seeking, I was the right person for that at this time.
I want to spend a little bit of time kind of dwelling there on the strength of your finance background. I made the comment when you said, you know, the challenge was part of the appeal. I said, you've got those in spades, because everybody does, you know. It's not, yeah. That's not a comment specific to Elevation. That's a comment specific to biotech, right? The entire industry.
Sure.
So share with me, like, what, like, how do you feel like, I guess the question is, how are you applying some of your financial strengths in this incredibly challenging market that we're in?
Yeah.
Like, give me some thoughts on, like, you know, what, you know, you can be a crack financier, but also recognize the fact that interest rates are through the roof, you know, that the VC appetite is incredibly, I used to use the word discerning. Now it's downright, to use a holiday term, Scrooge-like. These external factors don't necessarily discriminate when it comes to your financial chops. So what can you do? Like, how can you apply those skills in such a tough environment? I know it's probably a hard question to answer.
It's, you know, but there's, as usual, so many layers. I mean, the first thing I'll say is at a more discrete standpoint, I mean, you mentioned interest rates. It's been a long time since we all as people have had to deal with a rising interest rate environment or a high interest rate environment. And that's especially true for high growth industries like biotech, and it also applies to tech, right? I mean, it's been decades since we've had to compete with the fact that investors can put their money somewhere and earn a decent return, right? Because for a while there was 0% interest rates. So I think anyone in our business who doesn't think that that has ripple effects that affects our day-to-day operations probably is either not willing to admit it or just choosing to ignore it, hoping that it's going to evolve for the better over time. Yeah. It doesn't shut things down, but it does affect it. Back to your question, and relevant to some of the other things I said, you know, people think about numbers, they think about finance, they usually think about it in the context of black and white, right? Thinking about accounting, you're in the red, you're in the black. For me, and over the course of my career, I've gained a greater appreciation, I'll say, of it's not only just about what the numbers are telling you, it's about what the numbers aren't telling you. It's about dealing with the gray area. And oftentimes in finance, you have to get to a certain amount of information, but then at a certain point, you just got to make a judgment call based on that information, because the numbers aren't going to tell you everything, no matter how hard you try. And even if they are claiming to tell you everything, chances are you should think twice and ask more questions, because there's probably some more things you need to figure out. And I think that same thing applies to, you know, developing drugs, whether it's at a large company or a small company. It's in, think of it in terms of inform your gut, and then you got to trust your gut. I think oftentimes in the science realm, by our nature, we want to feel like we got to get all the information we can before we can make a decision. And the reality is you just got to get to a point where you think you've taken in all the information you can get, and then make a judgment call based on that. And more than anything, at a very high level, I think my experience in finance got me comfortable with making tough decisions in that gray area. I've always felt that the job of any leader, first and foremost, is to make sure that the people around you and the teams that work for you, that your first job is to make sure they have the resources, and that you are there to help them make sure, get rid of barriers that can get in their way. That's almost like job number one, because I've never been the type of leader that feels like I have all the answers, quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. But what I can do is help my teams, who are the experts, figure out and navigate the tough waters, per se, of all the roadblocks that are going to get in their way. And the more I can remove those roadblocks for them, the better off that I'll be, the better off that we will be, and the better off our mission will be in accomplishing our mission. So it's all of that uncertainty that comes with finance, I think, is even more relevant for drug development, but even more relevant for where we are as a sector now. Capital is very tight. Capital is very scarce. Every company is having to scrutinize every single dollar, and by extension, every single thing that they're doing. That's just a product of where we are. Some of that's interest rates. Some of that is about risk tolerance that the investors have, that the stakeholders have. And because of my background in doing that for multiple companies, I feel like I've been able to help Elevation, you know, move in the way that has helped us raise more capital this year, leverage some of the information that our partner put out there at a medical meeting in the middle of part of this year, and leverage that to raise more capital so that we have the runway as a company to execute on our own trial. We started our own trial in August of this year, and we're now treating our own patients. And we have the benefit of doing that with 2 years of runway to be able to execute, because we're in a stage now where it's all about execution. And if you can focus on job number one, two, and three, which is helping patients, and doing that where you have the capital to make sure the team can operate, then you're doing really well in this current environment so that you can live to fight the next fight and the next fight after that.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. One of those tough decisions you mentioned, I mean, you already talked a little bit about it, was, you know, the decision to take a monoclonal antibody and kind of set it aside and move forward with an ADC program. And I don't want to speculate here. I think about, like, I have a friend named Joe Dakash, who's an analyst with Decibio. I don't know if you know Joe or not, but Joe's life, his professional life is dedicated to analysis of the ADC space. And in a call with him not too long ago, we were talking about the space and just the incredible growth there, the excitement, the advances, right? The advances in linker technology, the advances in antibody drug ratios that, you know, make him very, very bullish about this space. He actually said to me, and I think he said it on record, so I'll repeat it here. He said, you know, this modality in this field has more potential, more patient potential than cell and gene therapy. you know, which, you know, you go to Philadelphia and say that, you're going to get, you know, strapped to a stake and flogged in the town square. But there's a lot of excitement around the space. And I guess the question is, again, I don't want to speculate here. I want your take on it. When there's excitement and movement, and I don't want to say hype, because I know that these advances are real. It's not hyped. But when there's excitement and movement around a specific modality or even term, I mean, cell and gene's been through it, right? Like, you know, 10 years ago, it was like all the small molecule companies started calling themselves biotechs because it was just sexy to say bio, you know what I mean? It didn't matter whether, you know, they're not playing in biologic modalities, bio is cool. ADC is like, you know, it's the cool kid on the block right now. And by virtue of that, perhaps there's the perception that funding might be easier to come by if we're focused on a hot modality. On the same token, antibodies are proven. You know, there's risk in shelving an antibody program because there are some investors in this very difficult market who don't want to take risks on newer modalities, particularly those who have been incredibly challenged in recent years, like, you know, not so recent, but previously challenged, like ADCs. So I'm using a lot of words here, and I'm going to let you use some words. But I'm just curious about how that sort of momentum in the ADC space contributed to the company's decision to say, you know what, let's strike that iron while it's hot.
Yeah, for sure. So as I said earlier, I mean, historically, I haven't had any experience with ADCs, but sitting here now, in addition to being the leader of a company with the lead program as an ADC, I am a true believer. And I think a big part of that is because the technology has come such a long way. I mean, ADCs have been around for decades, but as usual with any other technology, early on, you know, the first generation, the second generation had promise, but had issues. But it's come such a long way, and there's so many opportunities now that ADCs can be directed towards that even a few years ago weren't possible. So I think big part of the reason why they're quote unquote hot is because there's a lot of potential there. And we all know cancer, right? Cancer's whack-a-mole. You shut down one process, chances are a few others pop up to try to get around it because it's biology, and biology is incredibly smart. The beauty of an ADC is it's not too targeted, but it's not too broadly distributed. You know, chemo is indiscriminate. It attacks every cell it sees. On the other hand, you have something that's very targeted. You have although it could be a true driver of cancer, chances are there could be other processes that the cancer can use, the cell process can use to go around it. An ADC, I see as being in that sweet spot where you are targeted enough and you're selective enough, but you also have the ability to be a little bit broad within the tumor to kill a few other things that are ancillary. And if you can, you know, dial that in correctly, and we have some tools as an ecosystem now to dial in that selectivity, to dial in that stability, to dial in the type of payload that you're delivering. So if you can wrap all that up, there's just a lot of potential there. And I think that's why you see ADCs are being really hot right now. Taking it back for us as a company, for Claudin 18.2, we honed in on Claudin 18.2 as a target early on as a company, as a target where we saw a huge amount of unmet medical need and a real opportunity to make a difference for patients. We didn't set off looking to do an ADC in Claudin 18.2. We looked at Claudin 18.2 as a target and realized, you know what? An ADC approach is the best approach there. You have the best opportunity to be able to help a broader range of patients. And you have what we think is the best opportunity to have a drug that has a right balance between dosability and effectiveness and safety and tolerability. So it was those kinds of characteristics that led us to an ADC approach for Claudin 18.2, which we think is the same reason why you see ADC being so popular nowadays. Yeah. We're, of course, very happy to be a part of that overall ecosystem. And I'm going to speak again about the team. I mean, the expertise of this team in oncology, but especially in ADCs, is a unique approach that we have that we hope to continue to leverage as we continue to grow as a company.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great segue to my next question. I mentioned my friend Joe a minute ago in DeciBio, and anyone who is familiar with Joe or DeciBio knows that Joe's got a great reputation for creating terrific infographics and posting them on LinkedIn and publishing them on outlets like mine, Bioprocess Online. I've published quite a few of them, and the space is so crowded, in fact, that it's always kind of fun for me when I see him post a new, breaking infographic. And it's an infographic that, does as comprehensive as humanly possible of a job of visualizing the ADC space. And it's always great fun for me to sit back and watch the comments. I have another friend who tells me one of the rules of life is to never read the comments, but the comments are always fun because there are so many players in this space that no matter how good Joe is at charting them all, the comments are going to be like, hey, you forgot that. Hey, what about us? What about it? Like, there are so many players in the space. So, and you started to allude to this Elevation's approach to differentiating itself, because, it's one thing to ride a burgeon, a wave, like there's a lot of momentum, there's a lot of players, it's a great ecosystem. And then there comes a point in any industry where you look around and you're like, there are a whole bunch of us, and we need to stand out, right? So talk to me a little bit about that. Like, what are some of the hallmarks of Elevation's approach that create differentiation from a increasingly crowded landscape?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I'm gonna repeat myself for something I mentioned already, which is we as a company, our baseline is not rooted in one specific therapeutic modality or one specific type of technology. We have the benefit and the ability to embrace what we think is the best of technologies. In this case, we have no inherent ADC technology, embedded in the company. What we do have is an incredible amount of wealth of knowledge amongst the team. And then we can use that knowledge and experience of the team to assess other technologies that are out there. We did that with EO3021, and we plan to do that with other programs overall. We think that sort of, we're not chained to anything specific. And this, of course, there could be two sides to that argument, but we see it as an incredible positive and incredible part about Elevation Oncology that is unique, and that we can constantly be able to leverage business development and partnerships to look at the best of what's out there and try to seek to work with them to make it even better. And I think it's that in that approach and where the rubber hits the road in our dialogues with trying to move programs forward is where our uniqueness can really stand out. And really how we've been able to stand out with other potential partners and other potential really key people and key companies in this industry, and show them that our approach and the strength of this team can really lead to different types of outcomes eventually to help all stakeholders overall. I always rely on in biotech, there's always like an intersection of you got to do what's best for patients, you got to do what's best for company, and then you got to also go to do what's best for our investors, right? Those overall are our stakeholders. And if we are, in order to be successful over time, companies like us, but especially Elevation Oncology, the more we can make sure that we live in the world where we're serving all of our stakeholders, the better off we'll be. And we think that by being unique in that our approach to looking at the best technology and evaluating the best technologies out there allows us to be nimble enough that we can continue to build in that zone where all of our stakeholders can benefit.
Yeah. When you reference technology, like being discerning and being able to leverage different technologies to afford that flexibility or that lateral, like that ability to move laterally, it's trendy, maybe not just trendy, but functional for a lot of companies these days to be a platform company. We have an antibody discovery platform. We have, platforms are super hot in the RNA space right now, So that's sort of the mechanism, right? Like we're a platform company, and this platform affords us the opportunity to spin off multiple candidates and move around and sell one here and there. We're going to maintain the platform and license out candidates and make deals. The business side will be more product or candidate based. So I guess the question is, I'm kind of curious, like when you mention the technologies and the people? Like, what, how would you sort of characterize the mechanism at Elevation that affords that sort of, you know, modality agnostic, but technology embracing approach? I don't know. I mean, is there a platform? Is there some sort of a mechanism in that technology that, that you guys are running with?
Yeah. So, in the case of EO3021, it was the very specific types of conjugation. I mean, with an ADC, a big part of understanding if it's applicable for a certain target is how stable the program is, how stable the molecule is. Because really what you have is you have an antibody with a payload associated. Oftentimes that payload, by its very nature, is a chemotherapeutic. But if you keep that attached and you're delivering it more specifically to the tumor by being selective and being targeted, then you are delivering the chemo to the area where you want it, and hopefully keeping it away from the area where you don't want it. And in for EO3021, there was very specific site-specific conjugation that our partner who developed the program looked at, was hopefully makes a more stable molecule so that when you dose the drug, you don't end up with a lot of free chemotherapeutic swimming around in the bloodstream. Instead, you have a more stable molecule that only gets delivered, that only largely only delivers the toxin directly to the tumor site. And that selectivity is, we think, is very relevant for Claudin 18.2, because in for Claudin 18.2, there's very little expression of it in healthy tissue. It's limited to just in the gut you see in healthy tissue. So it's a great opportunity for an ADC to deliver a chemotherapeutic to the tumor, but keeping it away from the healthy tissue. That works for the Claudin 18.2. There may be other instances where in other types of targets where you want a different approach. And it was that sort of thinking about what's best for Claudin 18.2 as a target that we evaluated as a team. And the team did a lot of great work in order to help us understand this more. For the next target and the target after that, there may be a different kind of approach that we think is going to be more applicable. But we have the flexibility, and we also have the viability to be able to evaluate that based on the specific target and leverage the strength of the team and the knowledge of the team, but then also, of course, leveraging other experts like the Joe you mentioned, in order to make sure that we're pushing towards a best solution based on the information we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. You were excited from the outset of the conversation when you had an opportunity to mention your clinical trial and the fact that you've got your own patients, your dosing. So give us a real quick glimpse back at the beginning of that effort, an update on where it is now and some thoughts on what the next steps are.
Yeah, for sure. And as I mentioned, when we in-licensed rights to EO3021 from a partner, CSPC Pharmaceutical, which is based in China, we were fortunate because they were already executing a phase one trial for the drug in China. So earlier this year at the ASCO meeting in June, they presented the first ever clinical data from their program for the drug, which by extension is our drug as well. It was incredibly validating and important for us as a company. When we started our phase one, which we started dosing patients in August, doing so knowing that we had a drug that was helping patients, right? They reported a 47% overall response rate in gastric cancer at that in the poster at ASCO, but that also that we had an overall profile that was well tolerated for patients, that was in line with some of those attributes that I mentioned earlier about what would expect based on the stability of the molecule. So it was incredibly important and incredibly de-risking for us as a company to be able to move into our own phase one trial, knowing that we had a drug that was helping patients. And we started in August, we started enrolling patients in August. We're at that stage of development where we're dose escalating. So we're starting at 1 mg/kg, which was a dose that our partner saw evidence of anti-tumor activity, and we're dosing up from there. And once we get to a dose that we think is going to be meaningful for the next stage, then we're going to focus very much on gastric cancer. Gastric cancer has a high unmet need. It is an area where patients to this day have very few options, and the options that they do have are not very helpful. So by focusing on gastric cancer, where Claudin 18.2 is known to be a target that is highly expressed, we think it's going to be an opportunity for us to move fast, hopefully for the better, for the benefit of patients overall. As with any other target where there's a lot of opportunity, there's a lot of competition, but we consider ourselves part of the lead pack, and we intend to execute in a way that we can continue not just to show the differentiation of our program, but also have speed of execution and effectiveness of execution so that we can show that we are a program with time that's going to be closer to helping patients rather than further away. It's always important in drug development to be best in class, but it's also really important to be as close to first in class as possible. And we want to maintain our ability to and optionality to have both with EO-3021.
Yeah. Where is the clinical trial taking your clinical trial taking place?
We currently started enrolling patients in the U.S., but we plan to expand that because gastric cancer is highly prevalent, not just in the U.S. and Europe, but highly prevalent in countries like Japan and Korea. So with time, we plan to make the phase one study an international study. Mm-hmm. We just started in the U.S. and we're going to expand internationally. And we've said publicly that we plan to have the first cut of data from our trial in the first half of 2025. So right now it's all about, you know, expanding sites, treating patients, helping patients, working with clinicians who, by the way, know that we have a drug that has already showed evidence of making a difference. And we look forward to sharing that and showing more of that with the world in the first half of 2025.
Yeah, fantastic. We'll be looking forward to seeing the results of that. I'm always, personally kind of enthralled or inquisitive about when you reach a milestone as the leader of a company, like first patient dosed. And granted, you had the benefit, I'd call it the luxury or benefit of having some precedent in the Chinese study.
Yeah.
But still, you know, when you hit that milestone and you're actually putting something that you're producing for the betterment of patient health into human beings, there's gotta be some, emotional, right? Like emotional attachment to that, some feeling, right? Some human feeling behind it, whether it's pride, anxiety, a combination,
all of the above.
Yeah, tell me about that. Like, when I ask you that question, answer it as though you're telling somebody who's going to experience the same thing someday, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, oftentimes. Well, pretty much all the time, and not just in this business, but just also in this ecosystem of developing drugs, you talk about patients, right? And inevitably, you're talking about it in third person. But who are the patients? They're us, right? And they're us and their family members. I mean, who hasn't, in this case, who hasn't been impacted by cancer one way or another? And I think it's easy to miss the human connection of it. And I think it's always been important. And I always remind everyone that, you know, I talk often with the people at the company to appreciate that, okay, we started dosing patients, but we started helping people. And yes, we are in the business. We are not a not-for-profit. And part of what we have to do is make the right decisions so that we can hopefully develop drugs for patients that are going to make a difference. But at its very basic level, we're connecting with people. And if we can help this person and help the next person and help the next person after that, then we're helping the ecosystem and we're helping our family members and we're helping ourselves. And it's part of the reason through all the challenges and the opportunities that you have in biotech and biopharma, why this continues to be the most rewarding. I tell people who don't do this, you know, friends, people I went to business school with, I mean, like, you know, the timelines in biopharma are long. It takes a long time to develop drugs. It takes a long time to get somewhere. In some ways, you want to say, we'd all be better off working in tech, where you hire five people and you go develop an app and hopefully you've created a good app and then you move on. But we're here because it's rewarding, because inherently, we are running a business, but we're here to make a greater good. And the opportunity to do that is so rewarding that it is so rewarding, and especially rewarding because it's not easy for all the other reasons we talked about. And yeah, being able to do that and the opportunity to do that is still to this day something I encourage everyone to who has the ability and the interest to make sure that they are able to take advantage of someday, because that reward means a lot to me. And I know it does to others.
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible. I've only been covering the space for, I don't know, maybe going on 4 years. I think I've been in life sciences. You know, I'm an old dog, but I covered tech in a lot of different industries the previous part of my career. These past four have been by far my favorite, because I get to talk with people like you who, you know, to your point, are they're in the long run for the right reasons. So much skill, so much capacity, so much intellect that could be applied in such, you know, get rich quicker industries. Yeah. But we're, you know, the application of those skills and that intellect in this space, it hits different. It's as my teenage daughter would say, it hits different.
Yes, that's very true. A tangent, but you know, one of the things I love to say,
tangents. I'm proud of them myself.
Yeah. So one of the things I love to say, which probably everyone at the company is sick of hearing me say, and I think I'm going to quote Eisenhower, but probably somebody else said it beforehand. But you know, planning is everything; plans are nothing. And I say that because, you know, how often in life, you know, you think you're going to go in one direction, things change, and you end up going in another direction. From a business standpoint, I think the process and the knowledge and the experience of planning, especially in biotech, helps you appreciate the puts and the takes, the pros and the cons, the what if this, the what if that. And so hopefully as a team, you gain that knowledge through the process. Yes, you hope to put a plan in place, mm-hmm. but you're also cognizant that things are going to change. That, because of the timelines associated with developing drugs, I think that is even more important in drug development than it could be in a multitude of other areas. And Eisenhower probably made that comment as it relates to, you know, government and government policy and things that we all know are complicated in and of themselves. But, you know, none of what we're doing in, use the name of your podcast, the business of biotech, is a straight line. And it takes an incredible amount of teamwork and the expertise of a lot of different people, and also, you know, people listening to each other and people thinking hard about these solutions. Those are the things that are going to make the difference. And with the timelines that you deal with in drug development, it comes down to the ability of the people to move through that planning and to move through the plans and how the plans change, that hopefully if you make the right decisions, not only have you done things that are right for patients, but you've done something that is incredibly rewarding as a team. And I think it's that part of the journey that I think we're all seeking, not just in life and not just in our work, but also in life. Yeah. And I've seen that play out so much, so often in our business, of teams being successful and getting somewhere and feel incredibly rewarding. And I want that for all of us. I want that for Elevation Oncology, and I want that for an ecosystem. And the more we can set ourselves up for that, not only will we be rewarded, but the patients, AKA ourselves, will be rewarded as well.
Yeah. I can't think of a better note to end on, Joe. That was terrific. I'll leave that last word with you. I really appreciate you coming on the show and giving us an update on all these moves at Elevation, what's been going on over there. We'll be paying attention to the trial, and at some point we'll have you back on the show to give us an update on progress and next moves for Elevation.
Well, it was great to talk to you for a while, Matt. I will come back anytime. I'd love to chat about it, and I look forward to the opportunity to do it again. And thank you again.
You bet. So that was Elevation Oncology's Joe Farah. I'm Matt Piller, and this is the Business of Biotech. We're produced by Bioprocess Online with support from Cytiva, which demonstrates its commitment to new and emerging biopharma at cytiva.com/emerging biotech. If you like listening in on conversations with biotech leaders like Joe, make sure you subscribe to the Business of Biotech podcast. Sign up for our newsletter at bioprocessonline.com/BOB. Hit us up on Apple, leave us a review, let us know how we're doing. And as always, thanks for listening.